that he was deranged, though all listened with intense curiosity. A few days later it was fully decided and agreed in every house that the unhappy man was mad. The legal authorities could not refuse to take the case up, but they too dropped it. Though the trinkets and letters made them ponder, they decided that even if they did turn out to be authentic, no charge could be based on those alone. Besides, she might have given him those things as a friend, or asked him to take care of them for her. I heard afterwards, however, that the genuineness of the things was proved by the friends and relations of the murdered woman, and that there was no doubt about them. Yet nothing was destined to come of it after all. 5 days later, all had heard that he was ill, and that his life was in danger. The nature of his illness I can't explain. They said it was an affection of the heart. But it became known that the doctors had been induced by his wife to investigate his mental condition also, and had come to the conclusion that it was a case of insanity. I betrayed nothing, though people ran to question me. But when I wanted to visit him, I was for a long while forbidden to do so, above all by his wife. "It's you who have caused his illness," she said to me. "He was always gloomy, but for the last year people noticed that he was peculiarly excited and did strange things. And now you have been the ruin of him. Your preaching has brought him to this. For the last month he was always with you." Indeed, not only his wife, but the whole town were down upon me and blamed me. "It's all your doing," they said. I was silent, and indeed rejoiced at heart, for I saw plainly God's mercy to the man who had turned against himself and punished himself. I could not believe in his insanity. They let me see him at last. He insisted upon saying good-bye to me. I went into him and saw at once that not only his days, but his hours, were numbered. He was weak, yellow, his hands trembled, he gasped for breath, but his face was full of tender and happy feelings. "It is done," he said. "I've long been yearning to see you. Why didn't you come?" I did not tell him that they would not let me see him. "God has had pity on me and is calling me to himself. I know I am dying, but I feel joy and peace for the first time after so many years. There was heaven in my heart from the moment I had done what I had to do. Now I dare to love my children and to kiss them. Neither my wife, nor the judges, nor anyone has believed it. My children will never believe it either. I see in that God's mercy to them. I shall die, and my name will be without a stain for them. And now I feel God near. My heart rejoices as in heaven. I have done my duty." He could not speak. He gasped for breath. He pressed my hand warmly, looking fervently at me. We did not talk for long. His wife kept peeping in at us, but he had time to whisper to me, "Do you remember how I came back to you that second time at midnight? I told you to remember it. You know what I came back for? I came to kill you." I started. "I went out from you then into the darkness. I wandered about the streets struggling with myself, and suddenly I hated you so that I could hardly bear it. Now I thought he is all that binds me, and he is my judge. I can't refuse to face my punishment tomorrow, for he knows all. It was not that I was afraid you would betray me. I never even thought of that, but I thought, how can I look him in the face if I don't confess? And if you had been at the other end of the earth, but alive, it would have been all the same. The thought was unendurable that you were alive, knowing everything and condemning me. I hated you as though you were the cause, as though you were to blame for everything. I came back to you then, remembering that you had a dagger lying on your table. I sat down and asked you to sit down, and for a whole minute I pondered. If I had killed you, I should have been ruined by that murder, even if I had not confessed the other. But I didn't think about that at all, and I didn't want to think of it at that moment. I only hated you and longed to revenge myself on you for everything. The Lord vanquished the devil in my heart. But let me tell you, you were never nearer death." A week later he died. The whole town followed him to the grave. The chief priest made a speech full of feeling. All lamented the terrible illness that had cut short his days. But all the town was up in arms against me after the funeral, and people even refused to see me. Some, at first a few, and afterwards more, began indeed to believe in the truth of his story, and they visited me and questioned me with great interest and eagerness. For man loves to see the downfall and disgrace of the righteous. But I held my tongue, and very shortly after I left the town, and 5 months later, by God's grace, I entered upon the safe and blessed path, praising the unseen finger which had guided me so clearly to it. But I remember in my prayer to this day, the servant of God, Michael, who suffered so greatly. Chapter 3 Conversations and Exhortations of Father Zosima. E. The Russian Monk and His Possible Significance. Fathers and teachers, what is the monk? In the cultivated world, the word is nowadays pronounced by some people with a jeer, and by others it is used as a term of abuse, and this contempt for the monk is growing. It is true, alas, it is true that there are many sluggards, gluttons, profligates, and insolent beggars among monks. Educated people point to these. You are idlers, useless members of society. You live on the labor of others. You are shameless beggars. And yet, how many meek and humble monks there are, yearning for solitude and fervent prayer in peace. These are less noticed or passed over in silence. And how surprised men would be if I were to say that from these meek monks who yearn for solitary prayer, the salvation of Russia will come perhaps once more. For they are in truth made ready in peace and quiet for the day and the hour, the month and the year. Meanwhile, in their solitude, they keep the image of Christ fair and undefiled in the purity of God's truth, from the times of the fathers of old, the apostles and the martyrs. And when the time comes, they will show it to the tottering creeds of the world. That is a great thought. That star will rise out of the east. That is my view of the monk. And is it false? Is it too proud? Look at the worldly and all who set themselves up above the people of God. Has not God's image and his truth been distorted in them? They have science, but in science there's nothing but what is the object of sense. The spiritual world, the higher part of man's being, is rejected altogether, dismissed with a sort of triumph, even with hatred. The world has proclaimed the reign of freedom, especially of late. But what do we see in this freedom of theirs? Nothing but slavery and self-destruction. For the world says, you have desires and so satisfy them, for you have the same rights as the most rich and powerful. Don't be afraid of satisfying them and even multiplying your desires. That is the modern doctrine of the world. In that they see freedom. And what follows from this right of multiplication of desires? In the rich, isolation and spiritual suicide. In the poor, envy and murder, for they have been given rights, but they have not been shown the means of satisfying their wants. They maintain that the world is getting more and more united, more and more bound together in brotherly community. As it overcomes distance and sets thoughts flying through the air. Alas, put no faith in such a bond of union. Interpreting freedom as the multiplication and rapid satisfaction of desires, men distort their own nature. For many, senseless and foolish desires and habits and ridiculous fancies are fostered in them. They live only for mutual envy, for luxury and ostentation, to have dinners, visits, carriages, rank, and slaves to wait on one, is looked upon as a necessity, for which life, honour, and human feeling are sacrificed, and men even commit suicide if they are unable to satisfy it. We see the same thing among those who are not rich, while the poor drown their unsatisfied need and their envy in drunkenness. But soon they will drink blood instead of wine, they're being led on to it. I ask you, is such a man free? I knew one, champion of freedom, who told me himself that when he was deprived of tobacco in prison, he was so wretched at the privation that he almost went and betrayed his cause for the sake of getting tobacco again. And such a man says, I'm fighting for the cause of humanity. How can such a one fight? What is he fit for? He is capable, perhaps, of some action quickly over, but he cannot hold out long. And it's no wonder that instead of gaining freedom they have sunk into slavery, and instead of serving the cause of brotherly love and the union of humanity, have fallen, on the contrary, into dissension and isolation, as my mysterious visitor and teacher said to me in my youth. And therefore the idea of the service of humanity, of brotherly love and the solidarity of mankind, is more and more dying out in the world. And indeed this idea is sometimes treated with derision, for how can a man shake off his habits? What can become of him if he is in such bondage to the habit of satisfying the innumerable desires he has created for himself? He is isolated, and what concern has he with the rest of humanity? They have succeeded in accumulating a greater mass of objects, but the joy in the world has grown less. The monastic way is very different. Obedience, fasting, and prayer are laughed at, yet only through them lies the way to real, true freedom. I cut off my superfluous and unnecessary desires, I subdue my proud and wanton will, and chastise it with obedience, and with God's help I attain freedom of spirit, and with it spiritual joy. Which is most capable of conceiving a great idea and serving it, the rich man in his isolation, or the man who has freed himself from the tyranny of material things and habits? The monk is reproached for his solitude. You have secluded yourself within the walls of the monastery for your own salvation, and have forgotten the brotherly service of humanity. But we shall see which will be most zealous in the cause of brotherly love. For it is not we, but they, who are in isolation, though they don't see that. Of old, leaders of the people came from among us, and why should they not again? The same meek and humble ascetics will rise up and go out to work for the great cause. The salvation of Russia comes from the people, and the Russian monk has always been on the side of the people. We are isolated only if the people are isolated. The people believe as we do, and an unbelieving reformer will never do anything in Russia, even if he is sincere in heart and a genius. Remember that. The people will meet the atheist and overcome him, and Russia will be one and orthodox. Take care of the peasant and guard his heart. Go on educating him quietly. That's your duty as monks, for the peasant has God in his heart. F. Of masters and servants, and of whether it is possible for them to be brothers in the spirit. Of course, I don't deny that there is sin in the peasants, too, and the fire of corruption is spreading visibly, hourly, working from above downwards. The spirit of isolation is coming upon the people, too. Money-lenders and devourers of the commune are rising up. Already the merchant grows more and more eager for rank, and strives to show himself cultured, though he has not a trace of culture, and to this end meanly despises his old traditions, and is even ashamed of the faith of his fathers. He visits princes, though he's only a peasant corrupted. The peasants are rotting in drunkenness and cannot shake off the habit, and what cruelty to their wives, to their children even, all from drunkenness. I've seen in the factories children of 9 years old, frail, rickety, bent, and already depraved. The stuffy workshop, the din of machinery, work all day long, the vile language and the drink. The drink, is that what a little child's heart needs? He needs sunshine, childish play, good examples all about him, and at least a little love. There must be no more of this. Monks, or more torturing of children, rise up and preach that. Make haste, make haste. But God will save Russia, for though the peasants are corrupted and cannot renounce their filthy sin, yet they know it is cursed by God and that they do wrong in sinning, so that our people still believe in righteousness, have faith in God, and weep tears of devotion. It is different with the upper classes. They, following science, want to base justice on reason alone, but not with Christ, as before, and they have already proclaimed that there is no crime, that there is no sin. And that's consistent, for if you have no God, what is the meaning of crime? In Europe, the people are already rising up against the rich with violence, and the leaders of the people are everywhere leading them to bloodshed and teaching them that their wrath is righteous. But their wrath is accursed, for it is cruel. But God will save Russia, as he has saved her many times. Salvation will come from the people, from their faith and their meekness. Fathers and teachers, watch over the people's faith, and this will not be a dream. I've been struck all my life in our great people by their dignity, their true and seemly dignity. I've seen it myself, I can testify to it. I've seen it and marveled at it. I've seen it in spite of the degraded sins and poverty-stricken appearance of our peasantry. They are not servile, and even after 2 centuries of serfdom, they are free in manner and bearing, yet without insolence, and not revengeful and not envious. You are rich and noble, you are clever and talented. Well, be so, God bless you. I respect you, but I know that I too am a man. By the very fact that I respect you without envy, I prove my dignity as a man. In truth, if they don't say this, for they don't know how to say this yet, that is how they act. I've seen it myself, I've known it myself, and would you believe it, the poorer our Russian peasant is, the more noticeable is that serene goodness. For the rich among them are for the most part corrupted already, and much of that is due to our carelessness and indifference. But God will save his people, for Russia is great in her humility. I dream of seeing, and seem to see clearly already, our future. It will come to pass that even the most corrupt of our rich will end by being ashamed of his riches before the poor, and the poor, seeing his humility, will understand and give way before him, will respond joyfully and kindly to his honourable shame. Believe me that it will end in that. Things are moving to that. Equality is to be found only in the spiritual dignity of man, and that will only be understood among us. If we were brothers, there would be fraternity, but before that they will never agree about the division of wealth. We preserve the image of Christ, and it will shine forth like a precious diamond to the whole world. So may it be. So may it be. Fathers and teachers, a touching incident befell me once. In my wanderings I met in the town of K my old orderly, Afanasy. It was 8 years since I'd parted from him. He chanced to see me in the marketplace, recognized me, ran up to me, and how delighted he was. He simply pounced on me. "Master, dear, is it you? It's really you I see." He took me home with him. He was no longer in the army. He was married and already had 2 little children. He and his wife earned their living as costermongers in the marketplace. His room was poor, but bright and clean. He made me sit down, set the samovar, sent for his wife, as though my appearance were a festival for them. He brought me his children. "Bless them, father." "Is it for me to bless them? I'm only a humble monk." "I will pray for them, and for you, Afanasy Pavlovich. I have prayed every day since that day, for it all came from you," said I. And I explained that to him as well as I could. "And what do you think?" The man kept gazing at me and could not believe that I, his former master, an officer, was now before him in such a guise and position. It made him shed tears. "Why are you weeping?" said I. "Better rejoice over me, dear friend, whom I can never forget, for my path is a glad and joyful one." He did not say much, but kept sighing and shaking his head over me tenderly. "What has become of your fortune?" he asked. "I gave it to the monastery," I answered. "We live in common." After tea I began saying goodbye, and suddenly brought out 1/2 ruble as an offering to the monastery, and another 1/2 ruble I saw him thrusting hurriedly into my hand. "That's for you in your wanderings. It may be of use to you, father." I took his 1/2 ruble, bowed to him and his wife, and went out rejoicing. And on my way I thought, here we are, both now, he at home and I on the road, sighing and shaking our heads, no doubt, and yet smiling joyfully in the gladness of our hearts, remembering how God brought about our meeting. I've never seen him again since then. I had been his master, and he my servant. But now, when we exchanged a loving kiss with softened hearts, there was a great human bond between us. I've thought a great deal about that, and now what I think is this. Is it so inconceivable that that grand and simple-hearted unity might in due time become universal among the Russian people? I believe that it will come to pass, and that the time is at hand. And of the servants I will add this. In old days, when I was young, I was often angry with servants. The cook had served something too hot. The orderly had not brushed my clothes. But what taught me better, then, was a thought of my dear brother's, which I'd heard from him in childhood. Am I worth it that another should serve me and be ordered about by me in his poverty and ignorance? And I wondered at the time that such simple and self-evident ideas should be so slow to occur to our minds. It is impossible that there should be no servants in the world, but act so that your servant may be freer in spirit than if he were not a servant. And why cannot I be a servant to my servant, and even let him see it, and that without any pride on my part or any mistrust on his? Why should not my servant be like my own kindred, so that I may take him into my family and rejoice in doing so? Even now this can be done, but it will lead to the grand unity of men in the future, when a man will not seek servants for himself, or desire to turn his fellow creatures into servants as he does now, but on the contrary will long with his whole heart to be the servant of all, as the gospel teaches. And can it be a dream that in the end man will find his joy only in deeds of light and mercy, and not in cruel pleasures as now, in gluttony, fornication, ostentation, boasting, and envious rivalry of one with the other? I firmly believe that it is not, and that the time is at hand. People laugh and ask, when will that time come, and does it look like coming? I believe that with Christ's help we shall accomplish this great thing. And how many ideas there have been on earth in the history of man which were unthinkable 10 years before they appeared. Yet, when their destined hour had come, they came forth and spread over the whole earth. So it will be with us, and our people will shine forth in the world, and all men will say, the stone which the builders rejected has become the cornerstone of the building. And we may ask the scornful themselves, if our hope is a dream, when will you build up your edifice and order things justly by your intellect alone, without Christ? If they declare that it is they who are advancing towards unity, only the most simple-hearted among them believe it, so that one may positively marvel at such simplicity. Of a truth, they have more fantastic dreams than we. They aim at justice, but denying Christ, they will end by flooding the earth with blood. For blood cries out for blood, and he that taketh up the sword shall perish by the sword. And if it were not for Christ's covenant, they would slaughter one another down to the last two men on earth. And those last two men would not be able to restrain each other in their pride, and the one would slay the other, and then himself. And that would come to pass, were it not for the promise of Christ that for the sake of the humble and meek the days shall be shortened. While I was still wearing an officer's uniform after my duel, I talked about servants in general society, and I remember everyone was amazed at me. What, they asked, are we to make our servants sit down on the sofa and offer them tea? And I answered them, why not? Sometimes, at least. Everyone laughed. Their question was frivolous, and my answer was not clear, but the thought in it was, to some extent, right.
G. Of prayer, of love, and of contact with other worlds.
Young man, be not forgetful of prayer. Every time you pray, if your prayer is sincere, there will be new feeling and new meaning in it, which will give you fresh courage, and you will understand that prayer is an education. Remember, too, every day and whenever you can, repeat to yourself, Lord, have mercy on all who appear before thee today. For every hour and every moment, thousands of men leave life on this earth, and their souls appear before God. And how many of them depart in solitude, unknown, sad, dejected, that no one mourns for them, or even knows where they have lived or not. And behold, from the other end of the earth, perhaps your prayer for their rest will rise up to God, though you knew them not, nor they you. How touching it must be to a soul standing in dread before the Lord, to feel at that instant that for him too there is one to pray, that there is a fellow creature left on earth to love him too, and God will look on you both more graciously. For if you have had so much pity on him, how much more will he have pity, who is infinitely more loving and merciful than you? And he will forgive him for your sake. Brothers, have no fear of men's sin. Love a man even in his sin, for that is the semblance of divine love and is the highest love on earth. Love all God's creation, the whole and every grain of sand in it. Love every leaf, every ray of God's light. Love the animals, love the plants, love everything. If you love everything, you will perceive the divine mystery in things. Once you perceive it, you will begin to comprehend it better every day. And you will come at last to love the whole world with an all-embracing love. Love the animals. God has given them the rudiments of thought and joy untroubled. Do not trouble it. Don't harass them. Don't deprive them of their happiness. Don't work against God's intent. Man, do not pride yourself on superiority to the animals. They are without sin, and you, with your greatness, defile the earth by your appearance on it, and leave the traces of your foulness after you. Alas, it is true of almost everyone of us. Love children, especially, for they too are sinless like the angels. They live to soften and purify our hearts, and, as it were, to guide us. Woe to him who offends a child. Father Anfim taught me to love children. The kind, silent man used often on our wanderings to spend the farthings given us on sweets and cakes for the children. He could not pass by a child without emotion. That's the nature of the man. At some thoughts, one stands perplexed, especially at the sight of men's sin, and wonders whether one should use force or humble love. Always decide to use humble love. If you resolve on that once for all, you may subdue the whole world. Loving humility is marvelously strong, the strongest of all things, and there is nothing else like it. Every day and every hour, every minute, walk round yourself and watch yourself and see that your image is a seemly one. You pass by a little child, you pass by, spiteful, with ugly words, with wrathful heart. You may not have noticed the child, but he has seen you. And your image, unseemly and ignoble, may remain in his defenceless heart. You don't know it, but you may have sown an evil seed in him, and it may grow. And all because you were not careful before the child, because you did not foster in yourself a careful, actively benevolent love. Brothers, love is a teacher, but one must know how to acquire it, for it is hard to acquire, it is dearly bought, it is won slowly by long labour. For we must love, not only occasionally, for a moment, but forever. Everyone can love occasionally, even the wicked can. My brother asked the birds to forgive him. That sounds senseless, but it is right. For all is like an ocean. All is flowing and blending. A touch in one place sets up movement at the other end of the earth. It may be senseless to beg forgiveness of the birds, but birds would be happier at your side, a little happier anyway. And children and all animals, if you yourself were nobler than you are now. It's all like an ocean, I tell you. Then you would pray to the birds too, consumed by an all-embracing love, in a sort of transport, and pray that they too will forgive you your sin. Treasure this ecstasy, however senseless it may seem to men. My friends, pray to God for gladness. Be glad as children, as the birds of heaven, and let not the sin of men confound you in your doings. Fear not that it will wear away your work and hinder its being accomplished. Do not say, sin is mighty, wickedness is mighty, evil environment is mighty, and we are lonely and helpless, and evil environment is wearing us away and hindering our good work from being done. Fly from that dejection, children. There is only one means of salvation. Then take yourself and make yourself responsible for all men's sins. That is the truth, you know, friends, for as soon as you sincerely make yourself responsible for everything and for all men, you will see at once that it is really so, and that you are to blame for everyone and for all things. But throwing your own indolence and impotence on others you will end by sharing the pride of Satan and murmuring against God. Of the pride of Satan, what I think is this. It is hard for us on earth to comprehend it, and therefore it is so easy to fall into error and to share it, even imagining that we are doing something grand and fine. Indeed, many of the strongest feelings and movements of our nature we cannot comprehend on earth. Let not that be a stumbling block, and think not that it may serve as a justification to you for anything. For the eternal judge asks of you what you can comprehend and not what you cannot. You will know that yourself hereafter, for you will behold all things truly then, and will not dispute them. On earth, indeed, we are as it were astray, and if it were not for the precious image of Christ before us, we should be undone and altogether lost, as was the human race before the flood. Much on earth is hidden from us, but to make up for that we have been given a precious mystic sense of our living bond with the other world, with the higher, heavenly world. And the roots of our thoughts and feelings are not here, but in other worlds. That is why the philosophers say that we cannot apprehend the reality of things on earth. God took seeds from different worlds and sowed them on this earth, and his garden grew up and everything came up that could come up. But what grows lives and is alive only through the feeling of its contact with other mysterious worlds. If that feeling grows weak or is destroyed in you, the heavenly growth will die away in you. Then you will be indifferent to life and even grow to hate it. That's what I think. H. Can a man judge his fellow creatures? Faith to the end. Remember particularly that you cannot be a judge of anyone, for no one can judge a criminal until he recognizes that he is just such a criminal as the man standing before him, and that he perhaps is more than all men to blame for that crime. When he understands that, he will be able to be a judge. Though that sounds absurd, it is true. If I had been righteous myself, perhaps there would have been no criminal standing before me. If you can take upon yourself the crime of the criminal your heart is judging, take it at once, suffer for him yourself, and let him go without reproach. And even if the law itself makes you his judge, act in the same spirit so far as possible, for he will go away and condemn himself more bitterly than you have done. If, after your kiss, he goes away untouched, mocking at you, do not let that be a stumbling block to you. It shows his time has not yet come, but it will come in due course. And if it come not, no matter. If not he, then another in his place will understand and suffer and judge and condemn himself, and the truth will be fulfilled. Believe that. Believe it without doubt, for in that lies all the hope and faith of the saints. Work without ceasing. If you remember in the night as you go to sleep, I have not done what I ought to have done. Rise up at once and do it. If the people around you are spiteful and callous and will not hear you, fall down before them and beg their forgiveness. For in truth, you are to blame for their not wanting to hear you. And if you cannot speak to them in their bitterness, serve them in silence and in humility, never losing hope. If all men abandon you and even drive you away by force, then, when you are left alone, fall on the earth and kiss it, water it with your tears, and it will bring forth fruit even though no one has seen or heard you in your solitude. Believe to the end, even if all men went astray and you were left the only one faithful. Bring your offering even then and praise God in your loneliness. And if two of you are gathered together, then there is a whole world, a world of living love. Embrace each other tenderly and praise God. For if only in you too his truth has been fulfilled. If you sin yourself and grieve even unto death for your sins or for your sudden sin, then rejoice for others. Rejoice for the righteous man. Rejoice that if you have sinned, he is righteous and has not sinned. If the evil doing of men moves you to indignation and overwhelming distress, even to a desire for vengeance on the evil doers, shun above all things that feeling. Go at once and seek suffering for yourself, as though you were yourself guilty of that wrong, Accept that suffering and bear it, and your heart will find comfort, and you will understand that you too are guilty, for you might have been a light to the evildoers, even as the one man sinless, and you were not a light to them. If you had been a light, you would have lightened the path for others too, and the evildoer might perhaps have been saved by your light from his sin. And even though your light was shining, yet you see men were not saved by it. Hold firm, and doubt not the power of the heavenly light. Believe that if they were not saved, they will be saved hereafter. And if they are not saved hereafter, then their sons will be saved, for your light will not die even when you are dead. The righteous man departs, but his light remains. Men are always saved after the death of the deliverer. Men reject their prophets and slay them, but they love their martyrs and honor those whom they have slain. You are working for the whole. You are acting for the future. Seek no reward, for great is your reward on this earth, the spiritual joy which is only vouchsafed to the righteous man. Fear not the great nor the mighty, but be wise and ever serene. Know the measure, know the times, study that. When you are left alone, pray. Love to throw yourself on the earth and kiss it. Kiss the earth and love it with an unceasing, consuming love. Love all men, love everything, seek that rapture and ecstasy. Water the earth with the tears of your joy and love those tears. Don't be ashamed of that ecstasy, prize it, for it is a gift of God and a great one. It is not given to many, but only to the elect.
I, of hell and hellfire, a mystic reflection.
Fathers and teachers, I ponder. What is hell? I maintain that it is the suffering of being unable to love. Once, in infinite existence, immeasurable in time and space, a spiritual creature was given on his coming to earth the power of saying, I am and I love. Once, only once, there was given him a moment of active, living love. And for that was earthly life given him, and with it times and seasons. And that happy creature rejected the priceless gift, prized it and loved it not, scorned it and remained callous. Such a one, having left the earth, sees Abraham's bosom and talks with Abraham as we are told in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and beholds heaven, and can go up to the Lord. But that is just his torment, to rise up to the Lord without ever having loved, to be brought close to those who have loved when he has despised their love. For he sees clearly and says to himself, Now I have understanding, and though I now thirst to love, there will be nothing great, no sacrifice in my love, for my earthly life is over, and Abraham will not come even with a drop of living water, that is, the gift of earthly active life, to cool the fiery thirst of spiritual love which burns in me now, though I despised it on earth. There is no more life for me, and will be no more time. Even though I would gladly give my life for others, it can never be, for that life is past, which can be sacrificed for love, and now there is a gulf fixed between that life and this existence. They talk of hell fire in the material sense. I don't go into that mystery, and I shun it. But I think if there were fire in material sense, they would be glad of it, for I imagine that in material agony their still greater spiritual agony would be forgotten for a moment. Moreover, that spiritual agony cannot be taken from them, for that suffering is not external but within them. And if it could be taken from them, I think it would be bitterer still for the unhappy creatures. For even if the righteous in paradise forgave them, beholding their torments, and call them up to heaven in their infinite love, they would only multiply their torments, for they would arouse in them still more keenly a flaming thirst for responsive, active, and grateful love, which is now impossible. In the timidity of my heart, I imagine, however, that the very recognition of this impossibility would serve at last to console them. For accepting the love of the righteous, together with the impossibility of repaying it, by this submissiveness and the effect of this humility, they will attain at last, as it were,
to a certain semblance of that active love which they scorned in life, to something like its outward expression. I'm sorry, friends and brothers, that I cannot express this clearly. But woe to those who have slain themselves on earth. Woe to the suicides. I believe that there can be none more miserable than they. They tell us that it is a sin to pray for them, and outwardly the church, as it were, renounces them. But in my secret heart I believe that we may pray even for them. Love can never be an offence to Christ. For such as those I have prayed inwardly all my life, I confess it, fathers and teachers, and even now I pray for them every day. Oh, there are some who remain proud and fierce even in hell, in spite of their certain knowledge and contemplation of the absolute truth. There are some fearful ones who have given themselves over to Satan and his proud spirit entirely. For such, hell is voluntary and ever-consuming. They are tortured by their own choice. For they have cursed themselves, cursing God and life. They live upon their vindictive pride, like a starving man in the desert sucking blood out of his own body. But they are never satisfied, and they refuse forgiveness. They curse God, who calls them. They cannot behold the living God without hatred, and they cry out that the God of life should be annihilated, that God should destroy himself and his own creation. And they will burn in the fire of their own wrath forever, and yearn for death and annihilation. But they will not attain to death. Here Alexei Fyodorovich Karamazov's manuscript ends. I repeat, it is incomplete and fragmentary. Biographical details, for instance, cover only Father Zosima's earliest youth. Of his teaching and opinions, we find brought together sayings evidently uttered on very different occasions. His utterances during the last few hours have not been kept separate from the rest. But their general character can be gathered from what we have in Alexei Fyodorovich's manuscript. The elder's death came in the end quite unexpectedly, for although those who were gathered about him that last evening realized that his death was approaching, yet it was difficult to imagine that it would come so suddenly. On the contrary, his friends, as I observed already, seeing him that night apparently so cheerful and talkative, were convinced that there was at least a temporary change for the better in his condition. Even 5 minutes before his death, they said afterwards wonderingly, it was impossible to foresee it. He seemed suddenly to feel an acute pain in his chest. He turned pale and pressed his hands to his heart. All rose from their seats and hastened to him. But, though suffering, he still looked at them with a smile, sank slowly from his chair on his knees, then bowed his face to the ground, stretched out his arms, and as though in joyful ecstasy, praying and kissing the ground, quietly and joyfully gave up his soul to God. The news of his death spread at once through the hermitage and reached the monastery. The nearest friends of the deceased and those whose duty it was from their position began to lay out the corpse according to the ancient ritual, and all the monks gathered together in the church. And before dawn the news of the death reached the town. By the morning all the town was talking of the event, and crowds were flocking from the town to the monastery. But this subject will be treated in the next book. I will only add here that before a day had passed, something happened so unexpected, so strange, upsetting and bewildering in its effect on the monks and the townspeople, that after all these years, that day of general suspense is still vividly remembered in the town. Part 3, Book 7, Alyosha. Chapter 1, The Breath of Corruption. The body of Father Zosima was prepared for burial according to the established ritual. As is well known, the bodies of dead monks and hermits are not washed. In the words of the church ritual, if any one of the monks depart in the Lord, the monk designated, that is, whose office it is, shall wipe the body with warm water, making first the sign of the cross with a sponge on the forehead of the deceased, on the breast, on the hands and feet, and on the knees, and that is enough. All this was done by Father Paisi, who then clothed the deceased in his monastic garb, and wrapped him in his cloak, which was, according to custom, somewhat slit, to allow of its being folded about him in the form of a cross.
On his head he put a hood with an eight-cornered cross. The hood was left open, and the dead man's face was covered with black gauze. In his hand was put an icon of the Saviour. Towards morning he was put in the coffin, which had been made ready long before. It was decided to leave the coffin all day in the cell, in the larger room in which the elder used to receive his visitors and fellow monks. As the deceased was a priest and monk of the strictest rule, the gospel, not the psalter, had to be read over his body by monks in holy orders. The reading was begun by Father Yosef immediately after the Requiem service. Father Paisi desired later on to read the gospel all day and night over his dead friend, but for the present he, as well as the father superintendent of the hermitage, was very busy and occupied. For something extraordinary and unheard of, even unseemly, excitement and impatient expectation began to be apparent in the monks and the visitors from the monastery hostels, and the crowds of people flocking from the town. And as time went by, this grew more and more marked. Both the superintendent and Father Paisi did their utmost to calm the general bustle and agitation. When it was fully daylight, some people began bringing their sick, in most cases children, with them from the town, as though they had been waiting expressly for this moment to do so, evidently persuaded that the dead elder's remains had a power of healing, which would be immediately made manifest in accordance with their faith. It was only then apparent how unquestionably everyone in our town had accepted Father Zosima during his lifetime as a great saint, and those who came were far from being all of the humbler classes. This intense expectation on the part of believers, displayed with such haste, such openness, even with impatience and almost insistence, impressed Father Paisi as unseemly. Though he had long foreseen something of the sort, the actual manifestation of the feeling was beyond anything he had looked for. When he came across any of the monks who displayed this excitement, Father Paisi began to reprove them. Such immediate expectation of something extraordinary, he said, shows a levity, possible to worldly people, but unseemly in us. But little attention was paid him, and Father Paisi noticed it uneasily. Yet he himself, if the whole truth must be told, secretly at the bottom of his heart, cherished almost the same hopes, and could not but be aware of it, though he was indignant at the too impatient expectation around him, and saw in it light-mindedness and vanity. Nevertheless, it was particularly unpleasant to him to meet certain persons, whose presence aroused in him great misgivings. In the crowd in the dead man's cell, he noticed, with inward aversion, for which he immediately reproached himself, the presence of Rakitin and of the monk from Obdorsk, who was still staying in the monastery. Of both of them, Father Paisi felt, for some reason, suddenly suspicious, though indeed he might well have felt the same about others. The monk from Obdorsk was conspicuous as the most fussy in the excited crowd. He was to be seen everywhere. Everywhere he was asking questions. Everywhere he was listening. On all sides he was whispering with a peculiar, mysterious air. His expression showed the greatest impatience and even a sort of irritation. As for Rakitin, he, as appeared later, had come so early to the hermitage at the special request of Madame Holakov. As soon as that good-hearted but weak-minded woman, who could not herself have been admitted to the hermitage, waked and heard of the death of Father Zosima, she was overtaken with such intense curiosity that she promptly dispatched Rakitin to the hermitage, to keep a careful lookout and report to her by letter every half-hour or so everything that takes place. She regarded Rakitin as a most religious and devout young man. He was particularly clever in getting round people and assuming whatever part he thought most to their taste, if he detected the slightest advantage to himself from doing so. It was a bright, clear day, and many of the visitors were thronging about the tombs, which were particularly numerous round the church and scattered here and there about the hermitage. As he walked round the hermitage, Father Paisi remembered Alyosha, and that he had not seen him for some time, not since the night. And he had no sooner thought of him than he had once noticed him in the furthest corner of the hermitage garden, sitting on the tombstone of a monk who had been famous long ago for his saintliness.
He sat with his back to the hermitage and his face to the wall, and seemed to be hiding behind the tombstone. Going up to him, Father Paisi saw that he was weeping quietly, but bitterly, with his face hidden in his hands, and that his whole frame was shaking with sobs. Father Paisi stood over him for a little.
"Enough, dear son, enough, dear," he pronounced with feeling at last. "Why do you weep? Rejoice and weep not. Don't you know that this is the greatest of his days? Think only where he is now at this moment."
Alyosha glanced at him, uncovering his face, which was swollen with crying, like a child's, but turned away at once without uttering a word and hid his face in his hands again.
"Maybe it is well," said Father Paisi thoughtfully. "Weep, if you must. Christ has sent you those tears. Your touching tears are but a relief to your spirit and will serve to gladden your dear heart," he added to himself, walking away from Alyosha and thinking lovingly of him. He moved away quickly, however, for he felt that he too might weep, looking at him.
Meanwhile the time was passing. The monastery services and the requiems for the dead followed in their due course. Father Paisi again took Father Yosef's place by the coffin and began reading the gospel. But before 3 o'clock in the afternoon that something took place to which I alluded at the end of the last book. Something so unexpected by all of us and so contrary to the general hope that, I repeat, this trivial incident has been minutely remembered to this day, in our town and all the surrounding neighbourhood. I may add here, for myself personally, that I feel it almost repulsive to recall that event, which caused such frivolous agitation, and was such a stumbling block to many, though in reality it was the most natural and trivial matter. I should, of course, have omitted all mention of it in my story, if it had not exerted a very strong influence on the heart and soul of the chief, though future, hero of my story, Alyosha, forming a crisis and turning point in his spiritual development, giving a shock to his intellect, which finally strengthened it for the rest of his life and gave it a definite aim. And so, to return to our story, when before dawn they laid Father Zosima's body in the coffin and brought it into the front room, the question of opening the windows was raised among those who were around the coffin. But this suggestion, made casually by someone, was unanswered and almost unnoticed. Some of those present may perhaps have inwardly noticed it, only to reflect that the anticipation of decay and corruption from the body of such a saint was an actual absurdity, calling for compassion, if not a smile, for the lack of faith and the frivolity it implied. For they expected something quite different. And behold, soon after midday there were signs of something, at first only observed in silence by those who came in and out, and were evidently each afraid to communicate the thought in his mind. But by 3 o'clock those signs had become so clear and unmistakable that the news swiftly reached all the monks and visitors in the hermitage, promptly penetrated to the monastery, throwing all the monks into amazement, and finally, in the shortest possible time, spread to the town, exciting everyone in it, believers and unbelievers alike. The unbelievers rejoiced, and as for the believers, some of them rejoiced even more than the unbelievers, for men love the downfall and disgrace of the righteous, as the deceased elder had said in one of his exhortations. The fact is that a smell of decomposition began to come from the coffin, growing gradually more marked, and by 3 o'clock it was quite unmistakable. In all the past history of our monastery, no such scandal could be recalled, and in no other circumstances could such a scandal have been possible, as showed itself in unseemly disorder immediately after this discovery among the very monks themselves. Afterwards, even many years afterwards, some sensible monks were amazed and horrified when they recalled that day that the scandal could have reached such proportions. For in the past, monks of very holy life had died, God-fearing old men, whose saintliness was acknowledged by all, yet from their humble coffins, too, the breath of corruption had come, naturally, as from all dead bodies, but that had caused no scandal nor even the slightest excitement. Of course, there had been in former times, saints in the monastery whose memory was carefully preserved,
and whose relics, according to tradition, showed no signs of corruption. This fact was regarded by the monks as touching and mysterious, and the tradition of it was cherished as something blessed and miraculous, and as a promise, by God's grace, of still greater glory from their tombs in the future. One such, whose memory was particularly cherished, was an old monk, Job, who had died 70 years before at the age of 105. He had been a celebrated ascetic, rigid in fasting and silence, and his tomb was pointed out to all visitors on their arrival with peculiar respect and mysterious hints of great hopes connected with it. That was the very tomb on which Father Paisi had found Alyosha sitting in the morning. Another memory cherished in the monastery was that of the famous Father Varsonofi, who was only recently dead and had preceded Father Zosima in the eldership. He was reverenced during his lifetime as a crazy saint by all the pilgrims to the monastery. There was a tradition that both of those had laid in their coffins as though alive, that they had showed no signs of decomposition when they were buried, and that there had been a holy light in their faces. And some people even insisted that a sweet fragrance came from their bodies. Yet, in spite of these edifying memories, it would be difficult to explain the frivolity, absurdity, and malice that were manifested beside the coffin of Father Zosima. It is my private opinion that several different causes were simultaneously at work, one of which was the deeply rooted hostility to the institution of elders as a pernicious innovation, an antipathy hidden deep in the hearts of many of the monks. Even more powerful was jealousy of the dead man's saintliness, so firmly established during his lifetime, that it was almost a forbidden thing to question it. For though the late elder had won over many hearts, more by love than by miracles, and had gathered round him a mass of loving adherents, nonetheless, in fact, rather the more on that account, he had awakened jealousy, and so had come to have bitter enemies, secret and open, not only in the monastery but in the world outside it. He did no one any harm, but why do you think him so saintly? And that question alone, gradually repeated, gave rise at last to an intense, insatiable hatred of him. That, I believe, was why many people were extremely delighted at the smell of decomposition, which came so quickly, for not a day had passed since his death. At the same time, there were some among those who had been hitherto reverently devoted to the elder, who were almost mortified and personally affronted by this incident. This was how the thing happened. As soon as signs of decomposition had begun to appear, the whole aspect of the monks betrayed their secret motives in entering the cell. They went in, stayed a little while, and hastened out to confirm the news to the crowd of other monks waiting outside. Some of the latter shook their heads mournfully, but others did not even care to conceal the delight which gleamed unmistakably in their malignant eyes. And now no one reproached them for it. No one raised his voice in protest, which was strange, for the majority of the monks had been devoted to the dead elder. But it seemed as though God had in this case let the minority get the upper hand for a time. Visitors from outside, particularly of the educated class, soon went into the cell too, with the same spying intent. Of the peasantry, few went into the cell, though there were crowds of them at the gates of the hermitage. After 3 o'clock, the rush of worldly visitors was greatly increased, and this was no doubt owing to the shocking news. People were attracted who would not otherwise have come on that day and had not intended to come, and among them were some personages of high standing. But external decorum was still preserved, and Father Paisi, with a stern face, continued firmly and distinctly reading aloud the gospel, apparently not noticing what was taking place around him, though he had, in fact, observed something unusual long before. But at last the murmurs, first subdued but gradually louder and more confident, reached even him. "It shows God's judgment is not as man's," Father Paisi heard suddenly. The first to give utterance to this sentiment was a layman, an elderly official from the town, known to be a man of great piety. But he only repeated aloud what the monks had long been whispering. They had long before formulated this damning conclusion,
and the worst of it was that a sort of triumphant satisfaction at that conclusion became more and more apparent every moment. Soon they began to lay aside even external decorum, and almost seemed to feel they had a sort of right to discard it. "And for what reason can this have happened?" some of the monks said, at first with a show of regret.